cliffcentral.com. Welcome, Gavin Rich, to the studio for a nice discussion, I suppose, around all of the stuff that's been going on in Springbok coaching, which is such a... that talk about a poison chalice. That is probably the worst job to get. When it goes well, everybody loves you. When it goes badly, everyone hates you. You can't win. Good morning, Gavin. How are you?
Not too bad, but Gareth, thank you. Thanks for having
me. Good. It's nice to have you here. Now, listen, Ben says this is the best book he's read in ages.
Well, that's very nice to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not lying. I'm not lying because you're here, and it's because it's Friday. It really has been fantastic so far.
Well, that's good to know. Oh, so far, you haven't finished it.
I'm a very slow reader, Gavin, because what I do is I reminisce, then I go to YouTube, and then I Google stuff, because I go, oh, that guy, I remember that, then I go back and look at things. And
Okay, now, it was initially called The Poison Chalice, then it didn't sell that well the first time, because I think people didn't know what a poison chalice was. But
You have to be really, the Springbok coaches, you
spell it out
fucking
for them.
Idiots. Then they suddenly get it.
Yeah.
All right, now, Alistair Coetzee is there at the moment. I saw him on TV last night. And first of all, these guys don't really say very much. They don't say anything at all. But I can't imagine that that's how they talk when they're in the change rooms or when they're on the field training with the guys. Then they probably say what they really think. You slow bastard. Or why are you in the team? Or why should I pick you? These are the kinds of things that they'll never say to the media. There seems to be this thing with sport generally and the media where they try to walk the most boring line they can so they can attract zero controversy. Is that about right?
It probably is right. I'm not so sure it's true about Alistair Coetzee, but certainly I know a lot of coaches quite well, and often feel that they have what I call the coach's face, which they put onto the public. And even when they're in the job, and then after they finish the job, I did John Mitchell's book, for instance.
Yeah.
And it was interesting working with him. Like, gradually he sort of opened up, and gradually, well, he was actually undergoing life coaching at the time as well. He's been doing it for 4 years. So he has changed as a person. And that's why I was very upset last year when he didn't get the Stormers job on the basis of ills that he, mistakes that he made 4 years ago. He has changed as a person. But Alistair Coetzee, What you see on TV is pretty much what you get, actually.
Really? With him. So he's consistent.
He does, very consistent and saying nothing. now, you speak to Alistair. I mean, there's been a few times he's even asked me, for advice on things. And he is quite personable, but at the same time, he has perfected the art of saying absolutely nothing. And what worries me is that I think that art of saying nothing actually goes across to the players, because I sometimes think that the Springboks at the moment are between games as well, that they're not quite sure what he wants. Like, he's in one breath he says we're going to go out there to run the ball, and then the next breath he says we've got to kick.
The moment you commit to anything, you end up with enemies.
Well, that's actually true. So I think I might have said that in the book. I think you're going to get to that part of the book later where I think he might be the cleverest coach, in the sense that so far he hasn't... Okay, obviously I wrote this book a couple of months ago now, and Alistair had only just taken the job, and I just seen a couple of his press conferences. But he's been very careful not to commit to anything so far.
It's like tightrope walking.
Yeah, his first... I don't know if you saw his first press conference, but his first press conference, he was asked, for instance, are we going to beat the All Blacks? And he fudged it by saying, we are the second best team in the world. Are we actually the second best team in the world? We weren't, because England are the second best team in the world at the moment anyway, but maybe we were at the time. He said we're the second best team in the world, and I was sort of thinking, well, that's not really answering the question. And then they were asking other questions about the game plan, and again he was fudging it.
Now, I was going to ask you, what are the common obstacles to all Springbok coaches? But clearly, without even having to think too much about all the others, the most obvious one is that you live in this world between politics and sport. Because you really are the political head. Like, you have a minister in a cabinet position, and then you have the director general. The coach is like a minister. It's the political head of the team. And then the captain of the team is the director general.
It's actually interesting you should say that, because somewhere in that book I do say that in South Africa, and what one of the early chapters, I say that in South Africa, the Springbok coach is like a prime minister, almost a prime minister of a country. Certainly for certain sections of the population, he would be seen as that. And well, the whole thing is, let's be honest, rugby isn't really a sport in this country. And it hasn't been for a long time. I mean, I'm talking about before isolation as well. I mean, the Springboks were hated by a large section of the population in the 60s and the 70s as well. So, and you know, that whole Springbok emblem issue was a very emotive issue too. So it's never really been, and people who are supporting the Springboks now, there might be people supporting the Springboks now who for years reviled them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if there is any other sporting code anywhere else in the world where a guy who comes in to coach that team will have to put up with that sort of situation. And you've got the situation where I live in the Cape, where large sections of the population support the All Blacks because historically they supported the All Blacks. So it's a heck of a job to take on if you think about it. You know, I remember John Smith saying that
What do these guys earn?
They don't get paid as much as the players. I mean, the players get paid millions, but the coaches, no, not a lot. I mean,
so
they're doing well if they get they might get almost a million in a year. But
so why would you even take this job? People are going to despise you afterwards, no matter how well put
it is. It's natural progression. You can't dick around in unions forever. And everybody wants the job for pride as well. There's so much pride and ego.
Also, Mark Andrews, I've quoted Mark Andrews quite a lot in the book, and the reason I chose Mark Andrews was because he's played under more Springbok coaches, the other one being Joost, but obviously I couldn't speak to Joost. So,
well, you could, but you struggled to understand.
Yeah, no, I couldn't speak to Joost even at that stage, which was a couple of years ago. Shame. So I spoke to Mark Andrews a lot, and what he said was that to be a Springbok coach, you've got to, as a starting point, you've got to have a big ego, because you've got to think that you can do better than the guy that's in charge, that has been in charge before you, and you've got to feel like you've got all the answers.
And you've got to herd these cats.
Yeah, and then they come in and they think they've got all the answers, but it takes a while for them to realize, hang on a minute. I mean, I said it to Peter de Villiers. I mean, I wrote his book in the end, but for a long time I was his biggest critic. Everybody thought I was his biggest critic. In fact, that's why he chose me to write his book, which was, I think was quite clever of him. But but he also respected me because I always dealt with him on rugby issues rather than other things. But you know, I remember when he took over, and after a couple of months he was moaning about the media and moaning about, like, you know, the pressures that he put up with. And I said, Peter, I said, what did you expect? I said, where were you living? That's what I said. Where were you living before you took this job? What planet were you on? And he said, like, how do you mean? I said, well, what planet were you on? Because you must know that the Springbok coaches have all had to put up with these pressures. I mean, it's not new that the media, like, you know, you're not the first Springbok coach to come in and take flack from the media. I said, Jake White took flack. Nick Mallett even took flack. Harry Fillion resigned because of the flack that he took. He couldn't take it. I said, you know, I don't know where you came from, but, you know, you've got to basically, I think the expression I use is, it comes with the territory. And it does come with the territory. So if you take on the job, and if there's anybody out there who wants to be a Springbok coach, you've got to accept that you've got the political pressure, you've got the media pressure, you've got these days the social media pressure as well, which is huge, which I don't think is influential in changing the coaches like maybe the mainstream media used to be. But yeah, you've got all those things. I mean, I wouldn't want the job.
Social media pressure certainly makes all the couch potatoes, it gives them a louder voice, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, social media.
You hear Bali on the weekend, she's irate with what happens in the rugby field. So it'd be fair to say there will never be a foreign Springbok coach then.
No, I don't think the right mind
would ever put up with this.
I don't think it's fair to say that, because I think once we've got to the point, I remember writing an article a couple of years ago where I said that, and a lot of my colleagues always remember this, it was after South Africa had just beaten Scotland very narrowly, Peter de Villiers' era. It was 2008 at Murrayfield, and Peter de Villiers was going on afterwards as if this is great, we beat Scotland at Murrayfield. Meantime, we were very lucky to win that game, and nobody actually used to lose to Scotland in those days. And I wrote a column the next day, which the headline was, "We are not Romania." Because I was talking about how we were slipping. And I said, like, you know, if we're starting, and we're doing it now. I mean, we're getting incredibly excited about beating Argentina at home. So, I mean, I actually want to write another article like that. Maybe we have become a Romania. I said, we're not Romania. We don't boast about beating Scotland. But my concern is that we are starting to slip to that point where eventually, what you're saying, the foreign coach, they've got a mental block against foreign coaches at the moment. I think that that's going to be eroded away, because I think that eventually they're going to have to actually accept that if you want to play the type of rugby that the South African public wants, and which the administrators say they want, and which all the TV commentators and so forth allude to, if you want to play that game, you need to get people in who have coached that game successfully. And there's only one person in this country who's coaching it successfully at the moment, is Johan Ackermann. And it's no coincidence, in my view, that he was brought in by John Mitchell initially, who was a New Zealander. So I think that it's inevitable that we're going to have to go to a foreign coach at some stage if we want to grow our game like people want to grow our game.
Gavin, you observed something called MCD, Mad Coach Disease.
Yes.
What is this?
They all get it. They all get it in the end. it's just when the pressure's on, the guys forget what worked for them before. They forget the strengths that they had when they took the job. They forget who their friends are sometimes, actually, which is a bad one. They start doing ridiculous things. Like, Jake White, I remember the first time I came up with that phrase, I think, was when Jake White was coaching the Box in 2000 and what year was it? It was 2005 when Skalkberger, 2006 when Skalkberger was injured. And he relied a lot on Skalkberger. I mean, Skalkberger was worth about five players. I think Jake admitted that. Suddenly, Skalkberger was injured. Suddenly, he puts Joe van Niekerk on the flank from number eight to open side flank. And Joe van Niekerk is patently not an open side flank. Then he tried Solly Tabalika, the late Solly Tabalika. Then he went through a whole lot of guys, and he never went for Luke Watson, who was the obvious choice at that time. And he was losing, and he lost 49-0 to Australia. And he was making statements and doing things that were just completely out of sync with how Jake White had been before. And it was just, it just confounded me. And then I said, it's almost as if, in the article I wrote, it's almost as if he's flying a Boeing and that he's dipped the nose towards the ground and he's wanting to fly the thing into the ground. Mad coach disease, and he had it for most of that year, but he got it back. He got his common sense back in time to win the World Cup.
But the book starts off brilliant. Just to get back to that with post isolation and the first coach and how amateur everything was. Like, you weren't allowed to have the team before Wednesday of the Saturday, which was just stupid. And everybody who had to be involved in the team had to be an ex-Springbok. So you never had like-minded professionals or anything like that. Now, obviously, it's got better since those days, but what do you think is still holding us back? I mean, is it the expectations? Is it the administrators? It's hard to really kind of pin down what all these pressures come from. Where does it stem from?
I think...
Louis Late.
I think, well...
Every problem comes from Louis
Late. A lot of people would say bring back Louis Late, well, if you could. But I wouldn't. I wouldn't agree with that. I think that one of the problems is that we have been behind the eight ball since 92. When he came back in 92, you're quite right, John Williams was appointed as the Springbok coach, and he didn't even know he was the Springbok coach. Somebody told him, he said, "You're the Springbok coach," and he said, "No, I can't believe that somebody would have told me." And but he kept on hearing these rumors and he read it in the newspaper the one day. So he phoned the SARU offices and he said, like, "I keep hearing that I'm the Springbok coach, surely this can't be true." And Ari Oberholzer was the general manager in those days of SARU. He said, "No, it is actually true." He said, "You are the Springbok coach." So he said, "Okay, well," said, "can I have a training camp?" And he said, "No, you can't have a training camp." And he says, "Why not?" He says, "Because we're playing the All Blacks in 3 months. I need to get the players together." He says, Dr. Late says we have a Currie Cup to win. In other words, Transvaal. And that was actually the problem, was in the isolation era, the provinces became too strong.
Right.
And we still have that problem now, and that the provinces that were strong then are still strong within the South African Rugby Administration. And unlike New Zealand, you're not thinking about the All Blacks, in this case the Springboks. You're always thinking about what's good for the Sharks or what's good for Western Province, and that really is the problem. And we've come in behind the eight ball, and we were very arrogant when we came back. We thought that we were best in the world. We thought that the Currie Cup was the World Cup. So we came back and we thought that we were brilliant. We quickly got disavowed of that notion, but it took a long time for people to realize that we actually had a lot of work to do. And unfortunately, I think that winning the World Cup might not have been a good thing in 95, because it gave us a false impression of where we were. And it has led to sort of an arrogance. There's an arrogance. That may be the heart of the problem. There's an arrogance that we, for years before isolation, we were the top in the world. Therefore, we still see ourselves as that, and we should be ruling the world, and we've got the best players, and it doesn't matter how many times we get beaten. We've still got this expectation that the Springboks should be beating the All Blacks. You know, but if you look at the reality now, we've only beaten them once in the last 5 years, and we're slipping, and I think we're going to beat them less and less. And I think maybe that's the heart of the issue, is that nobody's sitting down and thinking, we've got a problem here, we need to address this thing, and we need to change the structures from grassroots level up. We need to work on the core skills that at the moment aren't being worked on.
Right. Now, how much of all of this, because I mean, Duncan here, for example, on WeChat says this morning, easy answer to Ben's question, politics is holding us back. But is that true? And is the Springboks coach's job ready to create transformation? Is there pressure from the ministry? Is administration part of the deal?
Yeah, well, the one thing is, I mean, I walked in here and I saw the words uncensored, which I love, because there's too much censorship in the South African media, and there's lots of different forms of censorship. And us as rugby writers have been censoring ourselves for 20 years because we know sometimes what parameters the Springbok coach is working within. But we're not really allowed to say it, or we don't feel it's good to say it. There's been way back since, I think, Nick Mallett's time. And I was actually part of the problem then, because I was one of Nick's biggest critics when he didn't choose Brayton Poulsa. And I said that, you know, you've got to be realistic. There's no such thing as a completely white Springbok team anymore. And sure enough, we've never had a completely white Springbok team since then, since 1999. But yeah, it's there are these guidelines that they have to work within, but the sports ministry don't want it to be made public. South African rugby until now haven't wanted to make it public. So in a way, you're sort of like operating within a lie all the time. I mean, somebody like Jake White used to get pilloried for choosing Hanyani Shamangi. And they were saying, why are you choosing Hanyani Shamangi ahead of, it was probably Gary Buerta in those days, the Blue Bulls hooker. Why is he choosing him? And I sit there and say, well, there's a simple reason why he's choosing him. It's because he has to choose so many black players.
Yeah.
But I never felt comfortable coming out and writing that.
What is that all about? Is that because that's exclusively a white media problem?
It is,
and like you don't want to call it what it is.
Well, you know what? I had the problem was in the Peter de Villiers era. Peter de Villiers, when he took the Bok coaching job, the first thing that he said, I don't want to be seen as the first black coach. I want to just be seen as another Springbok coach. And I listened to what he said then. And that's why he respected me, and I think why I ended up writing his book. I decided that I'm going to actually treat him as another Springbok coach. I'm going to treat him like he was Jake White. So I criticized him when he stuffed up. Mm. And I had a couple of my colleagues come to me and say, you're treating, in fact, there was with ex-player or two as well. I said, you've got to be careful about this because there's political sensitivities. And I said, nonsense. I said, I'm being completely sort of non-racial. I'm treating him as a Springbok coach, not as a black Springbok coach.
That's the whole problem, though, is we talk about sensitivities, but actually that's deeply patronizing.
I agree.
Like, I think that there is probably not one single black or any other, you know, colored Indian person who's ever said to me, yeah, please do treat me differently because I want you to feel patronized and I want you to have a different set of standards for me. It's what I call the bigotry, the soft bigotry of low expectations.
It's why we came up with the title for Peter's book, Politically Incorrect. Was because Peter did not want to toe that line.
Yeah.
And he did not want any.
And I
want
think
to
a lot of people really liked him by the time he
absolutely,
read.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I feel that, look, I don't think he was a great coach, but I think that South African rugby missed a beat by not employing him as a sort of rugby ambassador at large.
But who is the cuckest coach we've had?
Probably Karel du Plessis, but it wasn't his fault. Or Rudolf Strauli, because Rudolf is actually a good rugby man, but he also lost it. He got mad coach's disease, like you won't believe. Started putting putty in the door so people couldn't hear what they were saying in team meetings.
You're joking.
No, that's paranoia. That's true. Yeah. No, I'm completely paranoid. Although now a week ago there was that big controversy about the All Blacks finding bugs, listening bugs. Yeah. So maybe Rudolf Strauli was ahead of his time. Maybe he knew that's what people were doing.
So would you say that Peter de Villiers had the toughest time as far as these coaches go? I mean, obviously you work very closely with him, but would he have had the toughest?
Well, no, I think Peter was his own worst enemy as well, to be honest. I mean, just his personality. I mean, he refused to be turned into a white. That's what he said to me in the book when we worked on the book, in the sense that he had these communication guys at SARU who wanted to
turn him into a Jake White.
Yeah, they wanted to turn him into Jake White. They wanted to make him say the things that they wanted him to say. And he just refused to do it. And that was what I liked about Peter de Villiers. Peter de Villiers was his own man. And that's what I don't think he was a good coach. If you ask me, should he have been the Springbok coach, I'd probably say no, although I think maybe he was good in the sense that I think maybe we needed a guy like him at that time.
What's happening with Yuri Roux and this money that's gone missing and the court case? And I mean, what's that all about? Ben brings it up every now and then.
Regan Hoskins then sort of
he resigned,
stepped down.
Yeah.
It all sounded
what's going on? Regan was actually defending Yuri for quite a while. There's a lot of things at play there, and it's actually quite difficult to talk about again because we're in South Africa and a censorship thing. But there are people, quite influential people in Stellenbosch who have it in for Yuri as well. And if you think about it, there's various.
Are you talking about the Stellenbosch elite?
The
big money people there.
Yeah, the big money people there. There's a big friction there, and that has driven the whole.
There's always been an influence and almost like insidious influence from business on rugby.
Well,
Afrikaans men who've done really well in business want to influence rugby. They all hire ex-rugby players for their boards and stuff. It's bizarre. It's this weird kind of, we can get close enough to it, maybe we'll also get some of the shine.
Well, let's go back in South African rugby history. The Broederbond for years basically ran South African rugby. Right. And then Afrikaans business ran South African rugby.
So we've got a hangover from that.
When I interviewed Andre Markgraaf for the book, we got horribly sidetracked because we ended up not talking about his Springbok coaching career as much as we started talking about the power plays that are going on behind the scenes. And he actually told me I should write a book about that, which I might well do.
That would be amazing.
I might well do that when I've got the energy. Because it's going to require a lot of digging. But there's so much going on, like, you know, between the different businesses and, as you say, that Stellenbosch money we're talking about. It could make quite an interesting book because
You wonder if these billionaires sit around with each other and say, I have an influence on what goes on in the Springbok team, and that gets them a major, you know, gives them a hard on, and they feel all excited about how important they are. That would be what their biggest thrill would be.
It is like that. And let's be honest, I mean, if you look at the French system at the moment, the French system is being propped up by these multi-billionaires who all basically have that effect. They like to just play. They've got so much money, they throw it at a rugby club.
For a billionaire, isn't the ultimate trophy to actually own a team? And if you can own the national team, even if you can influence them, that's your way of lording it over your rivals.
Absolutely. And I mean, Jake White used Rupert as a, you know, as a safety net several times during his tenure. When he'd get in trouble with the administration, he'd end up being bailed out by Johan Rupert. And now I think that Johan Rupert's more in opposition than supportive, like he was in 2007 when Jake was last the coach. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that change dynamic. Something's been done to irritate Rupert.
Oh, okay. So now he wants change.
I think it's got to do with TV rights.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I work for Super Sports.
How's he involved in TV rights?
Isn't he involved with ETV?
I don't know. Is he?
I was told that he was.
Who watches that anymore? Who watches ETV?
It's completely unrealistic.
Just wrestling and porn on ETV.
Exactly. It's quite unrealistic to think that ETV would take over the rugby rights. But the national body actually was very concerned about that all the time. I mean, Super Sporter.
And
the national body.
Now, tell me about Oregon Hoskins. What kind of a guy is this?
He was interviewed on John Robbie's show in 2007 after the Luke Watson. You remember when Luke Watson was added to the Springbok team?
Yeah.
He was the first ever white quota player.
He was the first ever white quota player. He was added to the team, and John Robbie interviewed, it was sent out on YouTube. And Hoskins was asked some quite probing questions by Robbie, and he just couldn't handle it, and he started actually playing the man and not the ball. Started having a go at John Robbie. I don't know if you ever heard that.
No,
you should have him on your show. You'd have a great time with Hoskins. I'd love to listen to that. No, he really He really just, like, you know, you expect a leader. You expect a leader to be a statesman, to be able to.
He's quite prickly, is he?
Yeah, he's very prickly, but he's done it another time. You know, I've been present when he's just lost it. So he's just not a leader because he doesn't have the temperament for that. He was actually, and to be brutally honest, he was chosen for the position. You know, he was elected to the position because he was the weak guy who could be manipulated.
Oh, right.
And I think over time, he became the strong guy because of his position. And he wanted to cling to power. But to me, he's always been intrinsically weak and intrinsically not really up to date with what modern rugby needs. The problem with South African rugby really is that we have people who are elected out of the club game. Who run a professional sport. In other words, the elected officials have too much say, and that was changed when Brian van Rooyen was the president in 2003-2004. Before that, Rian Oberholzer was the chief executive, and Silas Nkanuni was the president, and basically he was the president but not the executive president, and Oberholzer dominated Silas to some extent. But then when Brian van Rooyen came in, he changed the whole system, and the 14 presidents are now the powerful people in South African rugby again. And those 14 presidents, as I say, don't necessarily have South African rugby at heart. They have their particular interests at heart.
Provincial interests,
yeah.
What about Cheeky Watson? I mean, he's no longer really an influential guy in it, but for a while there, he thought he was.
Read Peter de Villiers' book. I mean, Cheeky tried to. I mean, Cheeky was Peter's big backer initially.
Yeah.
And he wanted Peter de Villiers to be the coach because he thought he would choose black players and he would choose Luke Watson. And a couple of weeks after taking the job, Peter de Villiers, being his own man, decided to reappoint John Smith as the captain. Cheeky Watson hated John Smith, and he wanted his son as the captain, and got really upset about this and took took Peter de Villiers on.
Oh, yeah.
About that. You remember there was that sex tape allegation and all that?
That was flimsy at best.
It was flimsy at best, but you know, if you speak to Peter, and it comes through in the Peter de Villiers book, that, you know, they feel that Cheeky's influences were behind all that. Because, I mean, he was threatened. Because Chris Hewitt, who was at the Springbok communications manager at the time, was very close to Cheeky. And he was the one who mentioned who brought up the sex tape to Peter.
Sure.
So
no shame.
But Luke Watson, Cheeky Watson pitched up in Wellington. It was Peter de Villiers' first test in charge of the box on New Zealand soil. Cheeky Watson came in, he booked himself into the Springbok Hotel. He saw Peter de Villiers. He said, "We need to talk." And so Peter de Villiers said, "Well, what do we need to talk about?" Because they had started to become estranged then. He says, "I'm here as the emissary of the sports minister," who was then the late Mackenzie. "I'm here as an emissary of the sports minister." He said, "His message to you is that you've got to choose Luke Watson. And you've got to do something." I can't remember what the other thing was, but that was Cheeky Watson, very sort of manipulative, and he came in and then when Peter spoke to the sports minister had no knowledge of that. So that's Cheeky Watson. I mean, he's always been a sort of shady character behind the scenes.
And now obviously no influence anymore.
Hopefully not.
Well, okay. There's no money left in the Eastern Cape for it to be influential.
Well, he fell out with the son as well, because I got to know Luke quite well later on in his career, and he matured, he grew up, and he said to me that, you know, he was used as a political pawn by his father.
Wow.
And they had a major fallout because, you know,
Realization. No, tell me what happened.
No. I mean, I don't get too much into their personal lives, but you know, they're supposedly a very religious family.
Did his dad also tell him which woman to marry?
That sort of thing. But his dad also then got involved with another. You know, it was one of those things.
Right. In other words, hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And Luke didn't take kindly to that because he remained religious and he couldn't understand his dad's behavior.
Yeah, it's cool when it suits you. That's what I find with a lot of these religious people. And not in this case in particular, but generally, it's lots of hypocrisy just waiting to be found. All right, there's so many other things that we could talk about in regard to the Springbok team. But do you think that there's any chance? You said earlier you think we're a bit arrogant and we think we belong at the top of the pile, but we never really should have thought that we belong there. Do you think there's any chance that we could see in, I don't know, let's give it a stretch. Let's say over the next 8 to 10 years, we could see South Africa being one or two on the rankings.
I think it's possible. I think there is the raw material in this country.
So what do we need?
Well, one thing we need is we need to get some clarity on how we deal with the foreign question. When I say the foreign question, the players who are leaving and going to play overseas. Do we select them or don't we?
I think they go because they make so much money there. Right?
They do, exactly. But if they're the Springbok contracts were worth staying for, and they are becoming like that now, the Springbok contracts are worth staying for. The guys will stay. You know, I mean, somebody like Dwayne Vermeulen was actually quite irritated that he was made an offer too late because he'd already committed to Toulon. But he would have stayed had the offer been made. You know, it wasn't that. Living in South Africa with the money that he was going to earn was much more acceptable to him, or much more appetizing to him than going to stay in Toulon. So there's that question. I think that, look, money's going to be an issue because the provinces in this country are losing money. I mean, I've heard 39 million rand lost in a year last year by the Sharks, and that's a lot of money. They try to cover that up, but I mean, I've heard that from the, you know, very good sources. 39 million rand. I mean, they're not letting their financials out at the moment. And the reason they're not letting their financials out is because it's going to be embarrassing. So there's a lot of money lost by them. I know that the Western Province, even, who are one of the more stable unions, have lost a lot of money. That's why they're letting some of their players go. The Lions at the moment are being propped up by Alton Ellis, from what I'm hearing. Everybody thinks they're doing well, but they've got one guy who's really sort of bankrolling them. That's what I'm hearing. The Bulls aren't drawing a crowd anymore.
Yeah.
They're not drawing a crowd anymore. The Cheetahs will always be the Cheetahs because they're in Bloemfontein. Let's be honest, it's not going to. they're not going to become a
it's not much room for growth.
Great force. So there's not that much money in the game. And Nick Mallett said on TV about a month ago that maybe what we need is to have fewer provinces playing Super Rugby. That would make, you know, obviously concentrate the depth more. And do what they do overseas, which is invite investors, you know, owners in, big moneyed owners to come in, and then you'll have the money in the game, and then maybe it'll improve. But to answer your question, I think we've got the raw talent. I really do, and I think that if we got a foreign coach to come in and coach the Springboks, I think that it is possible. A foreign coach, of course, is a difficult thing to contemplate in this country, given the current requirements vis-a-vis transformation.
Yeah, that would be the big thing.
There's not too many news. I mean, I remember when the Hurricanes were here to play the Sharks a couple of months ago. I remember I had a drink with Chris Boyd, their coach, and John Plumtree in a couple of days before the game. And they were both like just saying, like, I don't know how you guys can put up with it. We just can't understand this whole thing, like, you know, that you've got to have so many players of color. And so, and I said, well, it's a South African reality. But the fact that they can't relate to it. Maybe Plum can a bit more because he was the Sharks coach. Sure. But Chris Boyd, you know, it's completely anathema to them. And that would be a stumbling block to getting one of those guys in to coach the box. But if we did have one of those guys to coach the box, I think we've got the raw material in this country and the talent to go back to number one or two. But you've also got to be specific about what you see as number one or number two. Winning a World Cup is actually quite easy, as we saw in 2007. You get New Zealand and Australia knocked out in the quarterfinals and you can win the World Cup. you don't have to play so many games against tough opposition in the World Cup. Let's be honest. I mean, the Springboks made a tough game out of the Japanese. Yeah. But their tough game in their pool was really Scotland. That was the only tough game that they had. And then they went into the quarterfinals and the semifinal. And the only tough game that they really played at the World Cup was the one they lost to the All Blacks. And that's quite easy. I mean, to win the World Cup in that sense, you've just got to hope that the All Blacks have a bad day or get knocked out by somebody else. The Tri Nations, or what that's now the Rugby Championship, is a lot tougher. And to me, I would like to see if we're really going to chase a culture of excellence. I always like to use that expression because I don't believe that there is such a thing in South African rugby. But if we were to chase a culture of excellence, in other words, we were just going to try and be as good as we could possibly be, and I think we would be really good if we did actually embrace that culture, then we need to not just be number one in the World Cup years. We've got to try and be consistent like New Zealand are and win the competitions in between as well.
Right. Okay, well, there we go. And there are a lot of good stories in this book. Ben was telling me you know, you obviously keep in touch with a lot of these guys. Some of them, you can't help bumping into at bars and sad places where they go to drink away their miserable post-rugby lives. But it's amazing that over the course of this incredibly interesting history of rugby, you also are able to pull in the threads of our own South African history, because there is so much of it that reflects what goes on in society.
It is. I majored in politics at Varsity, and I remember going, when I went into journalism, people were quite sort of shocked. How did you end up doing rugby? I mean, like, you know, they knew that I was a rugby nut and that at Varsity I loved my rugby. And I said, well, actually, because they said that we all thought you were going to go into politics, because that was my sort of bent in those days. And I said, well, actually, in a way, I have gone into politics. It is rugby isn't just a sport in this country. And at a very young age, I was following the box and as sort of the group writer for the Independent Group, and there was a lot of politics in those days. The Louis Late wanting to sue Madiba.
Do you remember that?
I mean, it was crazy.
Unbelievable,
it was crazy,
right?
But I was on top of that. I mean, it was great stuff to write about, in a way. It was crazy, but it was, you know, I thrived on that because of my political leanings as well. It was crazy, but yeah, we South African rugby hasn't helped itself. We won the World Cup in 1995 on this whole One Nation vibe, and you know, unity and having the whole country behind us. And then the following year, when Mark Croft was the coach, we threw it all away by just doing ridiculous things, like telling the crowd that it didn't matter if they waved the old South African flag.
That wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, no. Well, Morne Duplessis, what happened there? Because I was there. Morne Duplessis called us together in the airport in Bloemfontein. It was the day after a game against the Cheetahs, a game against the Wallabies.
Yeah.
Morne Duplessis called us in. We was at the airport, and he said, listen, I'd just like to make a statement. I saw the old flag being waved yesterday a couple of times, and I'd just like to put out a statement that, you know, we at South African Rugby, we Springboks, we don't support that, and we don't feel that we are supported by those people. And then Francois Pienaar, who's got like a big reputation in South Africa, but like actually, you know, if you dig, he's, you know, Francois isn't quite the great guy that everybody makes him out to be.
Oh, really?
And Francois Pienaar came out and basically said, no, they can wave whatever they want. But obviously, because in those days he was still the boy from Witbank, really, at heart. And he had friends that obviously got upset with what Morne said. And then Morne got vilified. It was Morne who ended up losing his job at SA Rugby because of that whole flag debacle. And we wondered then at the end of that year why suddenly this whole great national vibe had suddenly been lost. It was because we did idiotic things like that. I remember I was sitting at a press conference in Cape Town, and Alex Bruin, I don't know if you know Alex Bruin, but he was an Australian who was the Springbok communications guy in those days. And obviously the flag issue was a big thing, and it was just before a test against the All Blacks in Cape Town. So I asked the questions of Morne about the flag. Alex jumps in, and he says, we'd just like to state that anything said by Morne on this issue is the view of Morne Duplessis and not the view of Safu.
They hang him out to dry.
So then I immediately, I became quite aggressive in my questioning. I said, Alex, are you saying that Safu then condoned the use of the old flag? It was huge. I mean, it was all over the front pages of the papers. But I mean, that was a ridiculous time. It was ridiculous, but it was fun. I was a rugby writer, but I was always on the front page because it was like politics all the time.
It's amazing. All right, listen, the book is terrific. It's called The Springbok Coaches, because people are stupid and they don't understand The Poison Chalice, which I think is hysterical. It's about every single coach. It'll give you a little insight into where Alistair Coetzee might go, but it covers, and in the end, at the back of the book, there is also a nice table of all the wins, losses, and draws by each coach, so you can figure out for yourself who the most successful one was. Brilliant book, The Springbok Coaches. Gavin Rich, thank you very much for coming to see us.
Thank you very much for having me.
What
it was
a
great
pleasure.
Fun.
There we go. Cliffcentral.com.